భద్రం కర్ణే విష్ణుయామ దేవాః భద్రం పశ్యేమాక్షభిర్యజత్రాః స్థిరైరంగైస్తుష్టువాగంసస్తనూభిః వ్యసేమ దేవహితాయుః. ఓం శాంతి శాంతి శాంతిః. May we hear with our ears what is auspicious. May we see with our eyes what is auspicious. May we enjoy with strong limbs and bodies the life allotted to us. Om, peace, peace. Peace be unto us all. The ultimate freedom . The motto of the Ramakrishna order is Atmano Mokshartham Jagat Hitaya Cha. That means for the moksha, for the liberation of one's own self, Atman, Atmanaha, and for Jagat Hita, for the welfare of the world. So since I'm going to have to appear twice this week and next week, I thought I would take one part of that motto today and the second part next time. So Atmano Mokshartham, for the liberation of oneself, Atmanaha, of the Atman, of oneself, for the goal of the liberations of one's own self. So, to do that, we always, Vedanta means the end of the Vedas, which means the Upanishads, the concluding portions, or the latest composed portions of the Vedas. And of the Vedas, 10 of them have been considered central, although the others are also definitely included. But those 10 were commented upon by Sri Shankaracharya. And his comments formulate the essence of what we now call Vedanta, although teachers in every age contribute their own aspect, their own addition to that. But Shankaracharya commented on 10 of these Upanishads. They're supposed to be 108, although they have not all been recovered, some have been lost. Now, of those he commented upon, the oldest are generally two, considered to be two of them, the Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya. So, the Brihadaranyaka is indeed huge, and the commentary is indeed huge. So, it's called Brihat, the large Aranyaka. One should say a few words about how these Upanishads originated, because that has a great deal also to contribute to our understanding of our position in this world. Really speaking, we come in to this life and we do, of course, initially what our parents suggest and what our parents show us. We generally follow along those lines. At some point we may go into a tangential direction for some reason or other, but nevertheless it is passed down from generation to generation. Now, what was the scheme of life in the days of these Upanishads was that after the normal period of student life, when the knowledge that was common in those days would be taught to the young people, after a period of student life, they would graduate. There was actually a graduation ceremony. We do have some records in the Taittiriya Upanishad. There's a record of such a graduation ceremony. Anyway, after having studied for quite some time in these schools, which were generally located in the retreats in the forests, then they would spend some time, they would go back home and they would get married, raise a family, contribute their best efforts for the maintenance of society. And then when they supposedly, when they saw their son's son, presumably daughter would be all right too. Anyway, that when they saw their first grandchild, that was a signal to them that something more needed to be done. And generally, that involved retiring to a hermitage. Some sage, there were so many hermitages in those days, a sage would, that is to say, someone who had achieved some degree of advancement in spiritual life would settle in a place for his own spiritual practices, and people would gather around him, students would gather around him. And this was especially to be done after retirement. The goal of life was always thought to be the realization that there is something behind life. There is something that interpenetrates this existence, something that is not subject to the limitations of this existence. It isn't that it comes into being, flourishes for some time, decays and passes away. That is, on the surface, this was seen, this was known, this was obvious to everyone. But certain people had discovered that this was not all there was to life. That the purpose of life was to realize a profound reality which was unchanging, undecaying, eternally satisfying, and that the realization of that, every stage of life had to be subordinate to that particular principle, that the purpose of life is to realize that which is eternal. We're given a non-eternal interval to realize something which is eternal. So that may sound contradictory, but that they had found in those days, by actual experience, that this could be done, this was achievable. Otherwise, what is it that we are going to do? What is it that, what does our life consist of? It's obvious we could make a great success in a physical sense or an intellectual sense, and we should definitely strive for that, and in those days they did strive for that. But no matter how much you strive for all these things, there's a final fact that is inescapable. This thing that you've slowly built up for yourself may contribute to the welfare of others, but as far as you're concerned, eventually it disappears. It decays and disappears. So the question was always, is there something more than that? And it was discovered that by certain means, certain attitudes, one could find within oneself something which was not decaying, which does not die. And so this became the ultimate goal. And all of life was organized in order to contribute to that goal, that there is something here which is not decaying, something here which is eternal, which has never been created, and which will never decay. It is something which everyone intrinsically feels in their own hearts, even if no formal acknowledgement of this is made. Everyone feels that we cannot really believe that this is only a temporary existence. In spite of all the evidence that we have all around us, people come into existence, they flourish for a while, they decay, they pass away. They may accomplish a great deal in this life, but their accomplishments don't go with them, except the imprint made on their own consciousness. The actual accomplishment contributes to life here, but does not go with them. But it had always been known, because there had always been evidence of it in terms of people who had realized that there is much more to life than this. So the purpose of life became to realize that. Other purposes, such as a success in this or that, development of this or that, that was all right. In those days, they had empires, and in fact, they had huge empires. The India itself extended all the way into Central Asia. And there's evidence of Indian influence in places like Cambodia. So it was a huge, I mean, on a material plane, India was a huge success, you could say. So it isn't that this world was sacrificed for the sake of this ultimate reality. This, in fact, the search after this reality gave much more peace and tranquility and a measure of confidence and realization than we would have. Now this is, the question has become much more prevalent. What is this all about? Because doubt and indecision and this sort of non-conclusion has become much more prevalent. But in that scheme of things, that everyone had a purpose in addition to whatever was required in this life, in that scheme of things, certain people developed this ability to actually perceive that profound reality which does not decay, which does not pass away. And they developed methods for transmitting this information to others, for actually leading others into that consciousness. So this was a very profound time. And in a way, what we're trying to do really is to regain not the actual physical characteristics of that time, but to regain that attitude, that life is meant for a profound purpose and it is open to all of us, that within us there is an infinite eternal reality which is accessible to us in various degrees. It may, for certain, under certain circumstances, for certain people, it may become a brilliant realization. But for everyone, in the heart of everyone, there is a place where it is known that there is an essence in each one of us which will not pass away, which does not have that characteristic of decay. There's something within us which is not subject to those laws. The body certainly is subject to those laws. That is quite clear and demonstrable. The mind is subject to those laws. That is equally clear and demonstrable. But there is a profound dimension to human existence, which is not the body and is not the mind. You can give it any name you want. You can call it the spirit. You can call it the Atman. Whatever name is given to it, there is within each of us that profound dimension. There is something which will not die. There is something which is eternally awake, eternally free. It only appears to be bound in this way and that way, and the bondage can be very severe, but the bondage is always of the body and the mind only. That element in each one of us is totally free and cannot, has never been destroyed or changed in any way. There is something, that infinite nature is present in all of us. So what is the goal of life? To somehow discover that. Yes, we have intermediate goals also in terms of obligations related to this plane of existence. But the idea is that one should never forget this, that within each one of us, no matter how the surface looks, that infinite reality is the essence, is the truth, is the core of our being. So this was especially demonstrated in the Upanishads. And of those, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Brihadaranyaka. Aranya is forest. Brihad means large. So it's the Upanishad that was taught in the forest. Of course, they all were presumably taught in forests, that is, in these forest hermitages, to which everyone wended after their obligations in this world were finished. See, one of our problems is that we, now in these times, is that we think that there is no end to our obligations in this world. Of course, as far as our work is concerned, we understand, yes, at 65 or some such thing, we are expected to retire. And so that particular life is given up, and then what? See, that is the problem. Then what? There is no real, generally speaking, there's no real thought of what after this. There was one of our people who passed away a long time ago, but when he retired, I asked him how he felt now that he had. He was a teacher, actually, and I think he was a music teacher. I think he taught piano. Anyway, I asked him how he felt now that he had reached retirement age and had actually retired. And he said, well, you know, it's just like, People gave me this piano at one time in my youth, and I've been spending my whole life at this piano, and then somebody has suddenly taken the piano away. So he felt utterly lost. Of course, he went on. It wasn't that traumatic an experience for him, but still there was that aspect of it. The thing is, we have to change our aim. The major part of our effort should be on the eternal. But we have no idea that there is such a thing. We think everything is changing, and everything that we see and experience does change. So we're quite justified in one sense in feeling that way. But there is something which these Upanishads proclaim to us. There is a dimension to our existence which was never created and which will never be destroyed. And that dimension of existence is what we need to pay attention to. In addition to all the things of this life that are necessary, this should always be number one. The infinite and the eternal that is within the hearts of each one of us. That should always be number one. Then, of course, all these other things have to be taken care of. Yes, indeed. But if you leave out number one, if you have a number that's all zeros, the total, it can have 150 zeros, the result is still zero. But if you put a one in front of it, you get a huge number. The more zeros you add, the larger the number becomes. But if that number one isn't in front, you can add zeros as long as you want, as many as you want. The result never changes. It is still zero. So what is that number one? That number one is the spiritual dimension of our life, which is by different people called by different names. And it's approached in different ways. But the concentration is always on the fact that there is such an entity which is eternal. And that is what we have to pay attention to. So this Brihadaranyaka Upanishad does this in several different ways. One way is, there was an assembly of scholars, of learned people, and in that assembly of scholars, there was one lady, her name was Gargi, and she had, each one of the people was supposed, there was one, these scholars were supposed to be asked questions. And the audience would ask questions of the scholars. The scholars would give their opinions, their answers. And in that way, that was one of the ways that the spiritual knowledge was spread through the society. Now she said, I have a question. If he cannot answer this question, he will have forfeited his right to be considered an accomplished, a realized person. And her question was very, very modern, actually. She asked, by what is all of this pervaded? In other words, what is at the heart of all these things? This every perception, what is at the heart of everything that we see, everything that we think of, everything that we encounter in any way? What is at the heart of that? Is there a central core to all of this? So, in those days, there were not 92 elements or 106 elements or something like that. There were just five elements: air, earth, ether, water, fire, like that. Everything was thought to be made of those as essential constituents. And one pervades the other. What is the most central of these five or six or however many elements there are? What is the most central one? What is the one that pervades all the others, the one that is all the others are built upon? And so after some questions, the answer given was space. Space is at the core of everything. Everything exists in space. Seems entirely reasonable. So in science also, the first thing you do when you have a problem in physics or astronomy is to posit a coordinate system. In other words, so that you can locate, if you have a coordinate system, that is, you're trying to locate an object in space, you say, you choose a center of coordinates somewhere, some convenient point, and you say, oh, this object is so far in the x-axis, and then you go along the y-axis at a right angle, so long, and then you go the z-axis. For some more distance, you can locate that object exactly. There are different types of coordinates. X, Y, Z is one. R, theta, phi is another. These are all details. Anyway, you can specify three coordinates, and that will locate each object in space, either three at right angles in a straight line, or one radial and then two angles. It's, anyway, the coordinate system can be thought of as being central. Now, Einstein, of course, contributed a tremendous idea to this when he suggested that space is actually curved, and that the presence of objects actually curves the space. Instead of a gravitational field surrounding every object, the presence of the object changes the appearance of the space. And the experiments were devised to show that, and they did show that Einstein was right. So, but anyway, the whole idea is that there is one fundamental idea, that's this coordinate system, which will describe every object in space, how that object changes from one point to another, or if it breaks apart and whatever happens to it. You use this coordinate system to describe all the different components it breaks into. So the coordinate system is all-pervading. Everything, it reaches into every manifestation. So this was, now we're talking about 2000 and whatever it was that all these things were decided. And this particular Upanishad is 4,000, 5,000 or something years ago. Anyway, Gargi gave this answer by what is everything that we perceive, but what is that pervaded? What is it that is common to every single object? And she said, akasha, space. Of course, exactly, you can argue whether she was talking about exactly the same thing or not. It doesn't matter. The basic principle is that there is something which pervades everything. So, wonderful. Okay, Yajnavalkya, the sage who was answering the questions, he said, yes, everything is pervaded by space. Space is used to describe everything. Wonderful. Then came the question of questions. By what is space pervaded? What pervades that which pervades everything? Now that is, how are you going to say that? You can say, well, it's a ridiculous question. It's a self-contradictory question. Swami Vivekananda made that point about some aspect of philosophy, that there are some questions that it doesn't make any sense to ask. But she asked it, thinking that if he could answer it, it would be absolutely the ultimate in philosophy. If he could not answer it, that showed he didn't know everything that he was credited with knowing. So his answer was, Yajnavalkya's answer was, the Supreme Brahman. Okay, wonderful. All right, another word. What do you mean by that? Then he explains what he means by the Supreme Brahman. And at the end of that, description, Gargi admits, yes, he has understood and he will never be defeated. So the question is, what did he mean by that? So here's his answer. She asked this question. By what, O Yajnavalkya, is that pervaded which is above heaven and below the earth, which is this heaven and earth, as well as what is between them, and which was, is, and will be? Is there such a thing which was, is, and will be? Of course, you can say the coordinate system, yes, it was, it is, it will be, it never undergoes any change. So that's fine. But when you ask the further question, by what is the coordinate system pervaded, by what is space itself pervaded, then he answers, that, O Gargi, which is above heaven and below the earth, which is this heaven and earth as well as between them, and which they say was, is, and will be, is pervaded by the manifested ether alone. By what is the unmanifested ether pervaded? He said, O Gargi, the knowers of Brahman say, this immutable Brahman is that. It is neither gross nor minute, neither short nor long, neither red in color, nor oiliness, nor shadow, nor darkness, neither air, nor ether. It is unattached. It has neither taste nor odor. It is without eyes or ears, without the vocal organ or the mind. It is non-luminous, without the vital force, etc., etc. Well, then you could say it's nothing. Well, I mean, it's everything is negative. It is not this, it is not this. Well, okay, it is not this, it is not this, that's fine. Well, possibly it doesn't exist either. But then he goes on. Under the mighty rule of this immutable O Gargi, the sun and the moon are held in their positions. Under the mighty rule of this immutable O Gargi, heaven and earth maintain their positions. Under the mighty rule of this immutable O Gargi, moments, days, nights, fortnights, months, seasons, and years are held in their respective places. Some rivers flow toward the eastward toward the white, from the White Mountains. Others flowing westward continue in that direction, and still others keep to their respective courses under the mighty rule of this immutable. Oh, people praise those that give. The divine beings depend on the sacrifices, and the ancestors are dependent on the offerings offered to them. So there is something which keeps, which makes this universe a cosmos rather than a chaos. That was one discussion. Is this a cosmos or is this a chaos? And as we see, when we look at the surface of things, we look at the not only physical, at the psychological aspect of things, there seems to be an order. There seems to be a method of analysis. It is not chaotic. So what is it that maintains that? What is it that makes us able to even ask the question? If this were totally chaotic, if there were no such thing as Brahman is described, as that infinite reality is described, if there were no such thing, we could not even ask the question as to whether such a thing exists or not. So that within which, that due to which this whole universe appears the way it appears. This is one of the arguments that is given, that this is not chaotic, this is not random, that there is an ultimate destiny or an ultimate purpose to all of this. So the question is, how do you find that purpose? How do you achieve that? How do you prove that this is so? I mean, you can make these statements, and she's asking him the question, and he's answering the question, and you could say, all right, well, how do you prove that? So that question each one of us faces every moment. Even if you make some sort of a statement about spiritual reality, we are challenged by approaching the spiritual question at all. We are challenged to do something about it, to actually make those whatever statements we feel are appropriate to describe our situation in this world. We are challenged to make that actually to prove that in our own life, in our own existence. So that is the aspect from which we are looking at this whole picture. Then there is the question of what is this? When we look at ourselves, what is it that we perceive? If we don't take this, of course, Gargi and Yajnavalkya were taking a total universal view. They were going to the very uttermost limit of generalization. If we come back to our own selves and say, what is it within us that we perceive, and how is it that we should approach? If it is true that this exists, that there is an immutable and eternal non-decaying, eternal substance, reality, however you want to put it, how do we determine that? How do we prove that to ourselves rather than simply accepting it as an article of faith, which is all right? But not everyone may feel this way. The accepting it as an article of faith is a very good position, because this is what basically you also do in science. It's called a hypothesis. You assume that something is there and you work using that principle. Yes, let us assume that this is true. And you do your general obligations, you live your life in in the best way you can, and you see whether your original assumption is verified in life or not. That is really the challenge to us. We're not asked to come to this ultimate conclusion like Gargi and Yajnavalkya about the ultimate state of the ultimate, ultimate, ultimate. That we can take from these great souls who have gone that route. But now, once we accept some philosophy, some principle, it's up to us to make that live in our own life. There's where our, obligation rests. So how do we prove this in our own lives? And for that, we can go to the Mundaka Upanishad. Upanishads are at the source of everything. So you can give up many things in this world, but if you give up the Upanishads, it's just like sitting on a tree and sawing off the branch that you're sitting on. Of course, it doesn't matter if you saw off that branch on the outward side, but if you happen to do your sawing between you and the trunk of the tree, then, of course, there's not much hope. So what are these branches that we're sitting on to get support? One of them is the Mundaka Upanishad. And these people are very bold. They start with this tremendous question. Each scripture has this element of great boldness. So it starts with when a person, a devotee, he's called a great householder. Shaunaka, he approaches a sage and he asks this particular thing, which I will quote in Sanskrit and then translate. Kasminu bhagavo vijnate sarvamidam vijnatam bhavatiti. What is that, knowing which? Kasmin vijnate, what is that, knowing which? Sarvam idam, all of this becomes known. Vijnatam bhavati. Is there something here that we can access, which, after we are able to access it, becomes a ladder or a way of perceiving the very heart of things? And where is that to be found? So the sage to whom the question was asked gives a very troubling answer. He says there are two types of knowledge. Dvevidye veditavye. There are two types of knowledge, two types of things that are to be known, knowledges that are to be known. There's a lower knowledge and a higher knowledge. Okay, fine, nothing challenging there. We're willing to accept that. But then he enumerates the lower knowledge. Aha, what is the lower knowledge? The Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda, Shiksha, Kalpaha, Vyakaranam Niruktam, Chandam, Jyotisham. And those are the four Vedas. This is all lower knowledge, mind you. The lower Vedas, the Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda, Shiksha. Then he names all the sciences of his day. The science of pronunciation, the code of rituals, the science of grammar, etymology, meter, the science of astrology, all the things that in those days were known. He says that's the lower knowledge. Well, so in a way, everything has been taken away from us. What is it? Everything that these people knew, and by extension, everything that we know these days, could also be considered the lower knowledge. Now, he's not saying it's not useful, but he's saying it's not fundamental. So what is the fundamental? The higher knowledge, what is that? Yaya tad aksharam adhigamyate. Adhigamyate, that by which is attained the what? Akshara, the undecaying. So this is our responsibility. This lower knowledge which we use in our everyday existence, that's fine. That is, has its own place, its own, there's a necessity for that. But it is not considered the highest knowledge. The highest knowledge is that which leads to the infinite and the eternal. So we are put under an obligation to try for this higher knowledge. Otherwise, the lower knowledge is easy to get. There's no great difficulty in studying all these sciences and grammars and whatnot that he was talking about. Even in this 21st century, we have all these marvelous things that do incredible jobs for us, and we can master all those. That's not that difficult. But what remains, even today, that same thing remains. All this is the lower knowledge. It gets us a lot of benefits in this world, but it does not get us this one thing. We do not reach the undecaying, the immortal, the infinite, the eternal. And the Upanishadic sages have told us such a thing exists. The modern sages have also again and again verified that. Sri Ramakrishna verified it, Swami Vivekananda verified it. In their own lives, in their own experience, sages after them, down to the present day, they say that the dusty roads of India have always been trodden by saints and sages in every generation. And that's not only India, other countries, this phenomenon also occurs. Somebody somewhere will always realize that there is something which is undecaying and eternal, and they'll be able to get it. St. Francis realized it. St. Teresa of Avila realized it. These are not things. This is our obligation. Our obligation is to try to reach this. Our obligation is not to be satisfied with the things that we can understand, can learn, even the things that we can intellectually decide are extremely good and satisfying. We want to spend a lot of effort doing that. Those things are all wonderful. So many social causes, so many things that we're called upon to try to support and to learn, to understand, to vitalize. There's all wonderful. There's no contradiction or no nothing to be said against that. But the only point is it is not enough. This is what this quote says. All the sciences of the present day are wonderful and necessary, but it is not enough. There's one additional science that is needed. That is the way to reach that which is eternal and undecaying. There is such a thing. This is what we're told by the people who have experienced it, but we're not asked to accept it necessarily. We can accept it on the basis of their word because we trust in them, that's fine. But we're allowed to question that. We're allowed to question it and to verify it for ourselves. And until we verify it for ourselves, really speaking, that is the thing that gives us the great confidence. If we ourselves begin to feel the reality of this. Now, how do you do that? What is it that is required in order to do that? And the Mundaka Upanishad, again, it's only Upanishads that you will hear concerning these things. They talk about the imagery of the bow and the arrow. As you aim your arrow at a target, so in that same sense, the mind has to be aimed at a certain target. There is within each one of us, at the very heart of our being, there is something firm, eternal, and unmoving, unchanging, and supremely satisfying. So where is that supreme satisfaction to be found? It can be found in so many different ways. But the one of the principal ways is within each one of us. That is the meaning of meditation. Otherwise, you simply close your eyes and think about this or, you know, some particular subject. That's fine. That's good. That's a method. But the what we're aiming for is that this inner concentration, the purpose of it is simply to quieten the mind. The whole thing is that our mind is exteriorized. If we can return that mind inward, at least for some time, when that inward gaze, when what we are looking at inwardly becomes very quiet, very calm, we feel the presence of something there. We feel the reality of an unchanging reality within ourselves, the voice of God within. So this is the method. If the mind becomes quiet and concentrated, not only quiet, but quiet and concentrated on a spiritual symbol, or a symbol that you consider to be spiritual or emblematic of that thing which we're trying to reach, that which doesn't change, which was never born, which will never die. That thing which is an emblem of that, which has been used as a symbol for that. So many such symbols are there. We concentrate our mind on such a symbol, and as we focus more and more, we can perceive the existence of such a thing. We can perceive the existence of a reality within each one of us. This is nothing that anybody is excluded from. If with a great yearning, Sri Ramakrishna put the highest emphasis on yearning. If we can yearn for that realization and then concentrate in some fashion as it's advocated in various scriptures and various traditions, yearning for that, for a perception of that inner reality. So far we only perceive what's in the mind and what the body reacts to. There is something else. If we try to concentrate our mind on that internal light, that internal effulgence, that using it as a symbol, choosing a symbol, so many spiritual symbols are there, so many great spiritual beings. A knower of Brahman, Brahmavid, Brahmaiva Bhavati, a knower of Brahman, Brahmavid, indeed becomes Brahman. Brahmavid, Brahmaiva Bhavati, indeed becomes Brahman. So by concentrating our mind with great devotion on that spiritual entity, that spiritual reality, we can feel the existence of such a thing. Okay, not all the bells and whistles might be there, fine. That's, you know, those things we're told will come. But we're not after all these bells and whistles. What we want to know is there such a thing? When you're looking at there's a building, and I mean you're in a building and someone says there is an animal here, there's a cat walking around the building, and you're trying to find that cat, and of course cats have ways of disappearing and appearing and disappearing again. You don't find it, you begin to doubt, is there such a thing? There's probably no cat, they were just mistaken. But suddenly you see just the end of a tail going around the corner. Then you know, okay, I haven't seen the cat, but I've certainly got that, I've seen enough of him to understand there is such a thing. So spiritual life is like that. If we can just get a little bit, by this concentration on these symbolic forms, symbols of that infinite reality, by concentrating on that and with great devotion, with great love, the heart has to become active. That is one of the key things. If we think about these things only, it will not really happen. The heart, we have to begin to feel that this is actually so. Feel the beauty and the joy of it. The heart has to become active, and then that also endues that vision, that thought with life. And being endued with life, it gets that reality which we are seeking. And as we progress, this is what is supposed to get us ever deeper into that consciousness. So that is the thing, but that is what we want. We want the consciousness of that, of the reality of that supreme dimension, which is the very foundation of our life. And if we can just get a little glimpse of it, it may come, it may go, but having a little glimpse of it, you know it's there. And knowing it's there changes the whole picture entirely. Thank you.